I'm Tommy McNeely reporting. A 17-year-old has been charged with murder for the killing of 10 people, mostly students, and wounding of others at a high school in the state of Texas. Students said the gunman was a school junior and started shooting just before 8 in the morning Friday at Santa Fe High School. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said police found explosive devices, including a Molotov cocktail, at the suspected shooter's home and a vehicle, as well as around the high school where the shooting took place. The governor spoke at a vigil about the tragedy.
We're going to be here every day until we ensure that Santa Fe Independent School District and this school are put back in place and normalcy is returned to your schools and safety is returned to your schools.
Police say there were no major indications that the suspect was planning the attack and had no criminal history. He recently posted a picture of a black T-shirt on his Facebook page that read, "Born to Kill," according to authorities. His classmates described him as quiet and unassuming. They said he played on the junior varsity football team and belonged to a local Greek Orthodox church. Rapidly flowing lava from Hawaii's Kilauea volcano isolated a group of about 40 homes in a rural subdivision, forcing the rescue of at least 4 people Friday by county and National Guard helicopters. The rescue came one day after the volcano erupted on the island of Hawaii, thrusting large plumes of ash kilometers in the air. The U.S. Geological Survey and the lava flow said the lava flowed at a rate of about 366 meters per hour. Thursday's violent eruption was the most powerful since the volcano became active earlier this month. Hawaii County civil defense officials said local personnel and the National Guard were securing the area and preventing people from entering. This is VOA News. Investigators continued to examine the wreckage of a plane crash in Cuba that resulted in more than 100 deaths. Officials say 3 survivors were pulled from the wreckage and they're in critical condition at the hospital. Cuban and other news media report the flight, operated by a Cuban state airline, was leaving Jose Marti International Airport Friday when the accident occurred. The witness said the aging Boeing 737 jetliner made an abrupt turn before it crashed and burned into a field just after taking off. The big day has finally arrived for Britain's Prince Harry and Meghan Markle as the couple married Saturday in the town of Windsor outside London. Prince Charles, Prince Harry's father, walked the bride down the aisle. The AP's Gregory Katz, who was inside the chapel, tells us that the service was a great success, with a triumphant sermon from the American Episcopal Church leader, Michael Curry.
The highlight for me was the sermon by Reverend Curry from the United States, the Episcopal bishop who really brought a lot of the black African-American church experience into St. George's Chapel. I thought that was very exciting. Also, the procession, it was phenomenal to see them come out of the church and go by in a horse-drawn carriage. The reaction of the crowds lining the streets here was just phenomenal. It's been an amazing day and really, I think, a triumphant day for the monarchy. They've shown so much new verve and excitement by bringing this woman into the family. I thought the mix of American and British culture was great.
That's AP's Gregory Katz reporting. A series of explosions killed at least 8 civilians and wounded more than 40 others in eastern Afghanistan. A provincial spokesperson for her eastern Nangarhar province told VOA the explosions occurred in the capital, Jalalabad, late at night at a cricket stadium during a cricket match. He said all 3 explosions took place inside the stadium around 11:30 p.m. local time. The Taliban has dismissed concerns its recent battlefield gains in western Afghanistan threaten security of a multi-billion dollar gas pipeline being laid through the area to link Central and South Asia. The project, known as TAPI, is planned to move natural gas from the world's 4th largest reserves through Afghanistan to the growing economies of Pakistan and India. The pipeline is to pass through several Afghan provinces, including Western Farah on the Iranian border. Earlier this week, Taliban insurgents assaulted the provincial capital, also named Farah, and almost came close to overrunning it. U.S. Air assisted Afghan security forces to force the rebels out of the city. Iraq's Electoral Commission said Saturday that a bloc led by popular Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who fought U.S. troops during the war, has won the most seats in Iraq's national parliamentary elections. Is marching toward Reform Alliance with Iraq's communists, 154 seats. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA
That's
News.
The latest world news from VOA. We'll be right back.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
And he is endorsing it today, and that is going to be like. And the people on the ground are saying, who are we? How are we? Are we going to change our identity every time we've got another king?
King Eswati officially changes the country's name from Swaziland to Eswatini.
The appointments are still work in progress. There are still a lot more appointments in the wings. President Bill is quite mindful of those who helped him to the presidency. He's a very grateful person. He will not forget that.
Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio releases a list of deputy ministers.
Because what's happening today is a continuation of what happened in 2015, when Nkurunziza made a third term.
And Burundian voters approve a new constitution that extends the presidential term from 5 to 7 years. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. King Eswati III has officially changed the kingdom's name from Swaziland to Eswatini after he signed a gazette Friday. The new name Eswatini means land of the Swazis. The king had made the name change on April 19 in a stadium announcement during the 50th anniversary celebrations of the independence of Swaziland. The name change reportedly angered some in the country who believe the king should rather focus on the nation's lethargic economy. For reaction regarding the official name change, I reached Mario Masuku, leader of the banned political group Pudemo in the Eswatini capital, Mbabani.
There is an act, number 80 of 2018, where the king on the 19th of April 2018, he signed an act to that effect. And we, as Pudemo, are saying, this is what we have always spoken against, the issue of decrees. If there should be anything to do with the name of the country, anything that needs to be done to change the lives of the people of Swaziland, that one should be done from a broad-based spectrum. The people of Swaziland should have had a say. But here it is just a decree. You know, this is based again on the national constitution, which also gives the king the power to act like that as an absolute monarch. We are not going anywhere. We are actually getting deeper and deeper into dictatorship in Swaziland.
But Mario, shouldn't the people feel proud about this name change? Because the name Swaziland wasn't changed after independence. A lot of countries, including your immediate neighbors, changed their names. This is the right name, they said, because now the people will be called Emaswati as more than one Liswati, if I may put it that way. People, they said, should be proud of that. What do you say to that?
It is not the issue of the name per se. We could have come up with the name Gangwane because these are the people of Ngwane. But it is the process. Maybe names should have been brought and a referendum come in to say what would people like themselves to be called. It is the process more than anything. Tomorrow, King Mswati may pass away, he may die, and another king comes and say, now you are people of Gangwane. You know, that's not the way to govern people. We as Pudemo are saying that this should be procedural. It should be a democratic process that must come. Let alone that the constitution also allows for anybody, a despot, a dictator, to just come in and say, tomorrow this is what you are. We are saying those things must stop. They are things of the past centuries.
But Mario, if you look at a lot of countries, particularly in Africa, there were no issues of a referendum for people to decide how they should be called. Although leaders at that time chose the name, like Burkina Faso used to be Upper Volta, the former president changed the name to Burkina Faso, land of upright men and women. So calling for that, supporters of the government are saying that it's a little far-fetched and unreasonable.
Yeah, my brother, what we are saying is that there must be some sort of consultation. Like I have said, one king will come in and change the name, and then another king comes in and changes the name. I am saying there should be a proper procedural consultation. He has called the name and he's endorsing it today, and that is going to be like. And the people on the ground are saying, who are we? How are we? Are we going to change our identity every time we've got another king?
The king said that Eswatini, people in the country could easily identify themselves with the country, because a lot of the times people confuse the country with Switzerland, and that is why there has to be some uniqueness. Don't you think it's reasonable?
No. I think that is, if anybody said that, that is just a petty reason. If I am a Swazi from Swaziland, I've always been. I didn't see any problem with that because I am a Swazi in the land of the Swazis, and that's it. And in Siswati, people have always said, where are you going to? I am going to Eswatini. This is in Siswati. I didn't need really to have somebody to change the name of the country like that. But it is not really the issue of the name. Whatever he called it, he could have called it X, he could have called it anything. But we are saying some sort of process, consultation should have come.
Mario Masuku is the leader of the banned Eswatini political group PUDEMO. He spoke with me from Imbabani. Sierra Leonean President Julius Maada Bio released a list of deputy ministers Thursday, this after the second list of cabinet ministers were confirmed by parliament. But some supporters of the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, say the president appears to have forgotten about them after working hard for the party to win the presidential election runoff. Critics also say that it will be unlikely for the president to keep all of his promises. This, they said, after the president said his government inherited the worst economy since the country's independence. For more about the latest appointments, I reached Mohamed Radu Swari, the Sierra Leonean Information Minister in the capital, Freetown.
The appointments have been roundly commended by Sierra Leoneans from all walks of life, because the appointments reflect every shade of opinion, every part of the country, a multidisciplinary set of appointments. For example, you had Dr. Lavalee, brought in from the IMF World Bank. She has over 22 years of experience serving in those multilateral institutions. So at a time like this, when the economy is virtually broken, being the worst economy we have inherited in living memory, you need old hands like those to help negotiate with multilateral partners to put the country back on course. You also had other people brought in. Dr. Senge, for example, he is from the MIT. He brings to the fore long years of innovation, particularly in the East African country where he was last based. He wants to help bridge the communications digital divide, because this government is very, very, very focused on digital transformation. So you need somebody like that, for which a ministry, a directorate of innovation has been established.
Supporters of the ruling Sierra Leone People's Party are saying they have been left out because they worked hard for the party and they've been left in the wilderness, their words, not mine, and that the government, and for that matter, President Maada Bio, has to do something for them. How do you respond to some of their concerns?
Well, I can only say no supporter of the SLPP can doubt my SLPP credentials. Nobody can do the same for the finance minister and a whole lot of us who have been appointed to cabinet positions. In the same vein, many of those who have been appointed to deputy ministerial positions are SLPP. But more importantly, His Excellency did say at his swearing-in ceremony and even at the inauguration that he is president for all Sierra Leoneans. So he does not see parties, he does not see tribes, he sees the best Sierra Leoneans who can contribute to the realization of our new direction agenda. However, having said that, The appointments are still work in progress. There are still a lot more appointments in the wings. President Bio is quite mindful of those who helped him to the presidency. He's a very grateful person. He will not forget that. We'll be delicately balanced with the fact that he is president of Sierra Leone and he wants to give jobs to Sierra Leoneans across the divide. So it does not look like sharing spoils.
Looking at the number of ministers available, the president said that this is the worst economy that any government has inherited since independence. How does he plan to get funds, revenue, to pay not only his cabinet ministers and deputy ministers, but to keep the promises he made, including free education, and how sustainable will these programs be?
During the campaign, and even in his seat opening of parliament, President Bio made it clear that he will bring a disciplined approach to leadership. He will provide an effective and efficient management of the state and its resources. In the first 2 weeks of his presidency, he has enacted the Treasury Single Account, which now brings into focus all resources held by ministries, departments, and agencies into the Consolidated Revenue Fund. By that means, and other fiscal disciplinary measures, including the suspension of all duty waivers, we have been able, for the first time in 2 years, to pay public service salaries without resort to overdraft and commercial lending. This is a testimony to the fact that he's walking every step that he said he would do. That is just one aspect of it. Also, we intend as a government to ensure that we increase domestic revenue mobilization. Like I said, we have suspended, put a temporary ban on timber exportation until we sanitize that industry to ensure that government gets much needed tax revenue. Other aspects include we will diversify this economy. He did say that in the state opening of parliament and establish a natural resource account to ensure that we do not fritter away resources accrued during boom times, we say for a rainy day. So yes, we have a very prudent approach to resource utilization. Again, I did say during his recent visits abroad, he has kept the delegations very mean and lean because he's very mindful of the dire economic straits the country finds herself in right now. Yes, we are committed to rejuvenate and rekindle this country's economy so that we are able to pay for our basic social services. You could recall that this year's Independence Day celebrations was not budgeted for because, in his words, until this country is able to pay for basic social services, they will not authorize disbursements from the Consolidated Revenue Fund to support Independence Day celebration. That is a step in the right direction, as has been widely hailed by Sierra Leoneans across the divide.
Mohamed Rado Soare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from Freetown. Ugandans reacted with shock following a scandalous report that suggests that some teachers at the famous Makerere University practice sex for marks. The report found that the teachers harassed students by luring them into their offices under the guise to discuss the academic marks. It followed a two-month inquiry into sexual harassment at Makerere University. The investigation found that many of the perpetrators were well known to both students and staff. For reaction about the scandal, I reached Papa Wire Salim, president of the Makerere University Old Student Union called the Guild.
The issue of sexual harassment has been a big one and has been an issue of concern in the university. But I just perhaps to note that for Makerere University to be the only organization in Uganda cited especially on an issue of sexual harassment would be victimization. The issue of sexual harassment is a global issue and it is not only affecting Makerere University, it is affecting even other institutions of learning. It is a big one that we need to combat as a group instead of victimizing the few societies or organizations that have been hit by this vice. And just to note, in Makerere University, it is absurd that we have had those rampant cases. But it would be a good sign that at least people are bold enough to come up and report these issues instead of suffering in silence.
What do you make of the university's action?
I would like to appreciate the Vice Chancellor that he saw this as a concern that needed to be addressed immediately. He constituted a committee to investigate all these issues and come to the bottom of it, especially when it comes to the root causes, how it is supposed to be addressed, and also the current policy that governs sexual harassment in Makerere University. The committee today invited us for a validation meeting, and they lay on table their findings, and we had an interaction just ahead of the amendment of the current policy. First, the current policy we have been operating on was put in place in 2006, and I'm glad that it is being reviewed. It had a few loopholes that the committee pointed out, and they are going to be addressed. The committee gave recommendations, and part of these recommendations are short-term, others are mid-term, and others are long-term. But at least I am glad that the university saw a prudent need to address this issue. But the issues that we have had that are very rampant are the ones of lecturers abusing the students. It is absurd that very many high-profile lecturers in the university have been implicated in this issue. Very many have been dismissed from the university, a total of 10.
I understand, Professor yes. Barnabas Nawangwe, the university vice chancellor, said 10 members of staff have been dismissed since 2006. However, there were also concerns that some of these rumors have been ongoing for a long time, and that even some of the victims report such incidents, very little or nothing is done by the school authorities to it. How does the school address this as a former student yourself?
Now, those are some of the recommendations that the policy made. That one, some of the students report these issues, but they are not addressed. So penalties have also been instituted for any of the university authorities where these issues are reported and no action is taken. But part of the blame goes on the current policy that we have been operating on, that the university management only ends at dismissing the perpetrator who has been found in the issue of sexual harassment. But when it comes to issues of legalities and going to courts of law, it is left to the student who is being affected to carry on the costs. And we have no witness protection in Uganda to protect such people so that when these issues go to court, they can freely give testimony against the perpetrators. But all these issues are going to be addressed, because the university now in the new policy is going to take on these issues, that it is not only going to end at dismissal, but after dismissing, a committee will be constituted to investigate, and the university legal department will take up this issue so that we come to a logical conclusion.
What do you make of some suggestions given by students who think that professors who are involved in such acts should be prosecuted by the state? Moving forward, what do you think are the best steps forward for the university to take to prevent future occurrences of this nature?
One, the university should not be afraid about speaking up about these issues. Yes, they affect the image of the university negatively, but something should be done. Because we have had some issues that are concealed. They are handled, but in a concealed way. All these issues should be made public so that we know such and such a lecturer was involved in sexual harassment. The issue was taken up by the university, and this is the logical conclusion that came up with. But you see, the biggest problem affecting us is that even if the government is taken on this, we even have loopholes when it comes to the policies by the government. And I'm glad the committee today also pointed out that the university should suggest, not only the university but even other stakeholders who are championing this fight against sexual harassment, should propose to the government that we must have comprehensive policies that address such issues. And the biggest one should be witness protection. When we achieve that, then the victims will feel free to give a testimony in court against these people so that we can have these issues come to a logical conclusion in courts of law.
Papa Wure Salim is the president of the Makerere University All Students Union called the Guild. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Burundian voters approved a new constitution that extends the presidential term from 5 to 7 years, according to provisional figures released on Friday, handing a major victory to President Pierre Nkurunziza. But opposition groups say Thursday's referendum on extending the president's power was undemocratic, as the country awaits the Electoral Commission's announcement of the results. Karine Kaniza is the spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security in Burundi. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her in Washington for her take on the referendum.
We've received
many accounts from different individuals, but one of the main coalition, FNL and UKRONA, their representatives were not allowed. FNL has actually issued a statement about that their representatives were not allowed to actually vote the way they wanted to. There've been accounts of harassment. Personally, and on behalf of the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security, I think our main concern right now is beyond the result, what is going to happen to those who would have voted no, to those who have, because there are also a number of people who have abstained from going, and basically what's going to be their fate in the hands of the regime in Burundi. That is our main concern right now.
Some people have described this as President Nkurunziza's 2034 power grab. But others also have pointed out that this vote may fundamentally change the politics and the governance of the country. Do you agree to that assessment?
Yes and no. The assessment I personally make is very simple. It's based on the history of the country. It is a trend. It is a phenomenon we see everywhere else. The distinction when it comes to Burundi is that so far we've had two legitimate, peaceful elections so far in Burundi. That was in 1961 and in 2005. All the other elections have been marred with violence, genocidal ideology, and mass atrocities. And because of that, that's why I'm saying yes and no, because what's happening today is a continuation of what happened in 2015. 2015, when Nkurunziza bid a third term, that was a game changer. That changed the politics of Burundi. And what Nkurunziza has been doing from 2007, 2008 onward is the dismantlement of the Arusha Peace Accord. That's what is at stake today. And that is very important. And the Arusha Peace Accord were not about ethnicity. It was not. They were not about Hutus and Tutsis. Hutus and the quotas were an instrument to something much bigger than ethnic quotas. It was about inclusive politics. It was about representation. It was about consensus-based state building. So that is gone. But it started in 2015. Based on a strategic paper that was shared by, that was circulated within the political party CNDD-FDD in 2011. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing today. It is just a continuation. The game changer, in my view, was in 2015. Now what's going to happen, though, it's the ultimate manifestation of what lies ahead, which is probably going to be a heightened level of violence, a heightened level of oppression, and basically the emergence. And again, I think that's where there's a little bit of a difference in Burundi. People talk about authoritarianism. I talk about fascism, because it's a radicalization of a consolidation of power in one individual who sees himself as someone who has a divine mission. Nkurunziza sees himself as having been given a divine mission to rule Burundi. He has said it himself. He said it himself repeatedly. He has uttered very strong warnings, violent warnings towards the people he perceives as being his opponents. So that's the situation we're being faced with.
Then what do you think needs to happen to put Burundi back on track for good governance?
I think we need to all legitimize, starting with you, with the media, a new wave of struggle. The struggle is for the rule of law. These are fighters for the rule of law. And it starts with the young people. That's all I have to say. We need to legitimize them and we need to support them.
Karine Kaneza is the spokesperson for the Women and Girls Movement for Peace and Security in Burundi. She spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Washington.
The flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from a collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Health Organization warns the Ebola outbreak in the Northwestern Democratic Republic of Congo poses a very high public risk, but does not constitute a public health emergency of international concern. There are 25 reported deaths from the outbreak, including three health workers. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports that 14 of the 45 suspected cases of the disease have been confirmed as Ebola. The bar for declaring this fatal disease an international health emergency has not been met for now. But the chairman of the WHO Emergency Committee, Robert Steffen, says this could change as the virus is no longer contained in the remote area of Bikoro, where it was first discovered on May 8th. He says a few cases have been detected in the large urban area of Imbandaka.
The risk is of international spread is particularly great because the city of Imbandaka is in proximity of the Congo River. You can travel on it to Kinshasa and across the border to Congo-Brazzaville. And that, of course, has a significant regional traffic across very porous borders there.
WHO warns the Ebola virus could spread to nine countries neighboring DRC. Steffen says the Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic, which are particularly vulnerable, are being supported with equipment and personnel. Unlike the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, which killed more than 11,000 people, the government of the DRC, the World Health Organization, and other agencies have responded rapidly to the current outbreak. Steffen says this immediate response bodes well for bringing the situation under control. Another cause for optimism, he says, is the availability of an experimental vaccine which appears to provide protection against the deadly virus. He says 4,000 doses of the vaccine have arrived in the DRC and vaccinations of health workers and other vulnerable people will begin on Monday. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The Zambian main opposition party, United Party for National Development, or UPND, boycotted a national dialogue aimed to resolve the country's political tension. The dialogue, which ended Thursday, was attended by opposition and civil society groups, but the UPND dismissed the dialogue, saying it was displeased with the organizers of the dialogue. The opposition party rather wanted the Commonwealth or the church in Zambia to mediate the talks. The government, however, says it would only accept a homegrown initiated dialogue. For reaction, I read Charles Kakoma, spokesman for the Zambian opposition party UPND in the capital Lusaka.
As UPND, we think that dialogue process was not organized in good faith. Originally, UPND had agreed to participate in a national dialogue process that was being facilitated by the Commonwealth. But the ruling party in Zambia and the government do not want the Commonwealth-led dialogue process. Instead, they organized some NGOs and some political parties that are surrogates of the ruling party to organize a dialogue process. And they said, no, we're not going to participate in that dialogue process. We think that even if the Commonwealth dialogue process is opposed by the ruling party, we think the best next option is to use the church, the mother bodies in Zambia, who in any case initiated the dialogue process which the Commonwealth agreed to. that the church should instead lead the dialogue process if you want the dialogue to be Zambian-owned and spearheaded by Zambians.
But Mr. Kakoma, some Zambians say that if ending the political tension that sometimes leads to violence is the aim of the UPND, then it must embrace every effort to ensure this is resolved, and that the refusal of UPND to participate in this dialogue is a clear indication that the party is disinterested in any effort apart from the mediators that you want them to organize the talks.
Well, we will participate in a dialogue process which we think is credible and is likely to bring positive outcomes. We cannot just participate for the sake of participating when we know that the ultimate agenda by the ruling party to use the surrogate political parties, briefcase parties, some of them are not even properly registered, and some of them have openly come in the open to support the ruling party. And those are not the type of stakeholders that we take seriously at the negotiating table.
There were some political parties and civil society groups who are opposed to the government, yet they were part of these negotiations. Are you saying that everything that was done, the party dismisses it, and that it's unlikely to resolve the problem since the tension mainly is between the UPND and the government? Why would the government only engage a few and neglect you when it aims to resolve some of these issues that you have raised?
Yes, the government and the ruling party is happy with the majority of those that attended the current VCID-led national dialogue because it suits into the agenda of the ruling party. They want those to support the agenda of the ruling party. And the agenda we know of the ruling party is to bring constitutional amendments that suit its entrenchment in power, and to bring amendments that will support the continuation of abuse of the Zambian citizens.
Critics of the UPND are saying the party boycotted the national dialogue just for the sake of boycotting, and that your party is finding excuses because it has demonstrated to Zambians that the party is disinterested in resolving the political tension and the violence associated with it to be resolved ahead of the next election.
Well, in fact, when you look at the type of delegates and the institution that participated, the major ones such as the Catholic Church and the other big churches in Zambia did not participate there because they concluded that was not a serious dialogue process. And even the ruling party themselves did not send any senior people to attend, but they sent juniors who had no authority and known people just sit at their desk. And that is why we thought that it was not a serious process. There's no way we could have sent our president to sit down with such people to talk about dialogue.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesperson for the Zambian main opposition party, UPND. He spoke with me from Lusaka. The United Nations Cultural Organization, UNESCO, and the New Zealand Charity Foundation have launched a new initiative to revive the dying Malawian folktales culture. The initiative helps a local arts organization relay folktale messages on stage. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the commercial capital, Blantyre.
Long ago, children in Malawi used to gather by the fireplace in the evening to listen to folk tales from their grandparents and other elders. These stories aimed to teach the children good morals and cultural values. Some of the stories warned against serving two masters, while others had the messages about the benefit of respecting elders. But now the culture of storytelling is dying as children are exposed to television, films and the internet. Christopher Magomelo is the assistant executive secretary for culture at Malawi National Commission for the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, in Malawi.
The tragedy that we're facing is that there's a lot of foreign values that are creeping into our society because we've stopped the tradition of telling folk tales to our children. Because that is how we shape morality, you know, a person into a responsible citizen.
But a new initiative, the Malawi Folktale Theatre Project, seeks to revive the old age tradition of storytelling. Under the project, more than 200 folk tales are being adapted into stage plays. A local arts group, Nanzikambe Arts Organization, is implementing the year-long project. Efred Kanchocho is the publicist for the organization.
Initially, we have just adapted 5 folk tales into stage drama. After the performances, we'll be having post-performance discussions with the audience just to teach people the lessons that the past generations used to learn.
The group plans to put the plays onto DVDs to be distributed to schools across the country. Minister of Education authorities say the project will provide a learning aid for the expressive arts subject in primary and secondary schools, which includes storytelling. George Muhango teaches expressive arts at Chitawira Primary School in Blanta.
Before, we used to teach them in class from books, just read for them, just tell them. But now that they will be able to see, because they will be personalizing how some of these folktales work, I think it will really help the Malawian children.
Magomero with UNESCO says that although the organization funds similar projects in other African countries, the folktale drama project is unique to Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini. I'm gonna call you Lola. I'm going to be your coco. Kagari alifai kuna toyo. Na tukichoka da twende moro. Usinipe gonjwa la moyo. Cause you them girls and lawyer. You know you're rocking with the best man. And I've been so lonely in my life. But now I can hold on tonight. Cause I decide. Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come.
I'm gonna call you Coco, I'm gonna be your lolo, wanifanya niwe kama popo. So many times that I want you, baby, baby, oh. Bring me some new love, take me to the top. So many times that I want you. 'Cause I've been so lonely in my life, but now I can hold on tonight. 'Cause I decide, 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 decide. 'Cause I decide, 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 decide.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini, come out to your chini. Don't you say that I would deny, get you down to my soldier. To me I wanna see you whine, let us get to that corner.
Don't you see I would not deny, let me hold your shoulder. I'm gonna really whine and take it slow, 'cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini,
'cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini,
'cause I'm falling in love.
Come out to chini, come out to your chini, come out to chini,
'cause I'm falling in love.
Ali quadra yaka, singa kiyangu
usisa
wale dasa babos tobina wabina babos ali tokota e tobuje ali tokota
angaba bengana ngana kale nakoma na via libanda nakoma ko vivre ne kingi e boye la ngabore na beba ngasi mabe kuti ali mabe ali ngata bango one two three doge ali mabe kuti Ali ma be kuti Ali ma be vini Mopa walobi oye kuya
Everything is nice The body's banging The time is right Money coming, I just the bright. Now God they make me shine.
Be mosquito, mo fellow oju daddy mi, atura lato do daddy mi, kinu wama du to bari mi, ayago lona fukari mi, inu lawa oju lari, jungle lawa no padi mi, miwa mako wo ye akari, ibile obi yo wo kari, we talking international money, yeah, ewa be act for ninde, mo go fellow oju daddy mi, kirora ma she faji mi, yeah.
Everything is nice, the body's banging. The time is right, I see the money coming. I just the bright, now God they make me shine.
That's why they call me a butter. Loot up, no show my butter. Kito blue, but why did you got that? Oh yeah, come on me, Jogumi. Shots out on Jogumi. Like my alarm, only mummy. The shell, Lua, could he sue me? But what got him a baby, look for me. Oh, you're me, love, I want to have a boomy. I love fiat or all be for me. Like so, Lua, you, Babumi. Oh, what did you get? Can you really shit? Oh, Lua, they come, I lose shit. You want to come, I leave, okay, quick. Reminisce to be the whole back with.
Everything is nice, the body's banging, the time is right, I see the money coming, I just the bright, now God they make me shine.
If my body na elele, I be the one you require.
Oh yeah, L for me, dance for me. Let them know say that you're happy for this. L for me, dance for me. Let them know say your body. If your body na wire, I could be your supplier. To flex, what is your name? Me, I be a man, Naira. There is no need to holler. I no come for your Naira. Just L.A. for me, L.A. for me. Then I will be your supplier. If your body go, then my body go. It will be like ready go. Oh, baby.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight, and from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpunga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when two elephants meet on a narrow bridge, they get nowhere until one of them backs down or lies down. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In a number of developing countries, democracy is in decline. That's because a democratic political culture requires a vibrant civil society sector and an independent media to keep the citizens well informed about the actions and performance of government institutions and officials. Only then do citizens have the means to freely influence public policies. But a free flow of information is anathema to autocrats and would-be dictators. So, despite all the technical developments since the turn of the century, which should improve access to information and social participation, including internet access, greater mobile phone ownership, and easy-to-use digital media platforms, the flow of information is being choked off. In recent years, dozens of governments have passed restrictive laws and regulations that diminish the ability of civil society organizations to register, operate freely, or receive foreign funding. At the same time, print, on-air, and digital news outlets and those who report and publish the news are restricted, shut down, and silenced, while journalists and editors are harassed, attacked, detained, and even murdered. Indeed, according to Freedom House, just 13% of the world's population enjoys a free press, a media environment where coverage of political news is robust, the safety of journalists is guaranteed, state intrusion in media affairs is minimal, and the press is not subject to onerous legal or economic pressures. At the same time, around 67% of all internet users live in countries where criticism of the government, military, or ruling family are subject to censorship. For that reason, the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, is helping to strengthen the legal environment for civil society in over 20 countries, works with local organizations globally to combat growing repression, expand civic space, and strengthen civil society, supports worker organizations to advance worker rights and access to justice in 27 countries, and helps provide civil society, independent media organizations, bloggers, and advocates with mentoring tools and techniques to bolster their information technology capacity and protect their security online. The stakes are high. In some countries, civil society and the media are the only institutions that keep power in check. Through USAID's many programs, the U.S. government works to keep them running.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.